Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Martha Kumar, author of Before the Oath, How George W. Bush and Barack Obama Managed a Transfer of Power. So, you know, one of the things you point out, and you mentioned about some of the hiccups that some of the incoming presidential administrations have dealt with, is around appointments. And I wanted to get a sense, maybe not necessarily the transition, but just your experience in this area. Why is that the case? Has that changed? Has there been some reform around nominations and presidential appointments? And what can we expect in the future?
One of the things to take into account is that we have a lot more people to appoint, because government is the layers of people that are appointed, the requiring Senate confirmation, have increased. Now, there's legislation that decreased it to some extent. They took out the PAS positions that were councils and departments that did legislative affairs, did communications. They decided that they actually did not need Senate confirmation, because it's hard to staff up a department and have all these positions, have all the policy positions, and then have those process positions as well have to go through through Senate confirmation. Their hurdles have become higher, but I think one of them is because of financial disclosure. Mm-hmm. That slows you down. Then one of the things you don't want to have happen is you don't want any nominations to blow up on you, because that's going to be a lot of bad press, loss of momentum, loss of goodwill. And so you have to work on preventing trouble. And so one of the things that administrations have developed is a personal data statement that asks a very large number of questions. It depends. Some of them have had under 20 questions, but usually one of the questions is, have you or any members of your family ever done anything that is going to bring disrepute on you, the president? So a lot of things fall into that category. So the process now of appointments is very intrusive. Mm-hmm. You know, in an earlier time, people didn't care as much about the personal backgrounds of people. Today, that is true, and that deals with things like who you've employed, what tax troubles you might have had. I think people sometimes just don't think that something is relevant, and then they find out, like, you know, who they hired as a domestic help, and they turned out to be undocumented, and that causes a big issue. So then that becomes a question that is going to be asked of everybody else. So you have, out of experiences, particular experiences, you have more and more questions that are asked. So the process takes a long time. And I think early in the administration, they were spending a lot of time trying to deal with financial crisis. Yeah. Anytime an appointment is causing you trouble, then that's going to slow the momentum, particularly in that department. If it takes some while to get somebody in, then that's going to cause trouble all the way down the line.
You mentioned in your book that the one of the benefits of getting together earlier in the pre-convention and then post-convention was that these folks got to know each other, both the Bush administration, outgoing, national security is a good example of that, or crisis training kind of thing. So there was a terror alert, which you start off in your book on Inauguration Day 2009. And I'd like to talk about that. How did the Bush team and the Obama team work together in addressing this issue? And what lessons were learned from this potential crisis event?
It was a when you look at the cover of the book, I have a picture of Bush and Obama walking out of the White House from the coffee they had had, and with their families and Vice President, both incoming and outgoing, and they're on their way to get into the limousine to go up to Capitol Hill. Before that, you had, while they were in the blue room, all of them having coffee, in the Situation Room, they were discussing the threat on the inauguration. The threat, fortunately, never materialized, but it was something that had concerned them for several days. It came up all of a sudden and then vanished. And the threat was from al-Shabaab. Mm-hmm. There was an alert that it was put out over the weekend that mentioned al-Shabaab. And they thought that it could be an IED, mm-hmm. but something that probably wasn't going to be close to the president, would be further back on the mall area, but something that could possibly kill people. So they had to work through that and think of what some of the alternatives were. They went through a possible crisis and discussed what kind of resources alternatives there were. And the more that people can get together, I think that's one of the lessons of this transition, is the better it is. That if you have information provided on paper, that's really important to have about how things work, but you can really discuss it in detail when you get together.
Well, Martha, in D.C., policy formation, the policy side tends to get much of the focus, the sexiness of policy development, with management and the implementation of policy really taking the back seat. From your perspective, why does management take a back seat in D.C., and what can be done to put it at the forefront and raise its station?
With Republicans, it tends to have be more of a priority than it is with Democrats. But I think in this administration, one of the things that happened was, even if they had had a strong management agenda, that they had to deal with a financial crisis. And that was just crucial. It was indeed a big crisis. And I think all of their other priorities had to take a back seat, although they had queued up a number of items like Lilly Ledbetter, but then they had to do the auto bailout and do the Recovery Act. And so I think that they were so involved in the policies that they had to develop and then implement, that management as a separate issue just it didn't seem to get a toehold. I think generally it's just it is so crucial to everything you do, but people often work on a calendar of what's happening next week, what's happening next month, and not thinking about how they're going to implement all of it. One of the things that you've seen in this administration is a large number of people who are acting heads of agencies and deputies, and they don't have the same kind of position that someone does who has been confirmed. And I think that has been a problem when you look at the Office of Management and Budget, and it's constantly been used as a farm team. And so, somebody does very well, like Sylvia Matthews, and, that's right, yeah. Jeff Zients ends up at the White House. And so that's, unfortunately, that's happened to an agency that's just particularly crucial to government, because the Office of Management and Budget is responsible for all the programs and people in the government, which is why the people who are there and have done well can be shifted kind of anywhere in government. But you want stability in that operation.
And there's a marked difference, because you worked with Clay Johnson. I know you had him discuss your efforts in the book. But Clay stayed as deputy director for the duration. And it's a marked difference between administrations. Yes. So there was that continuity. And he pressed the PMA, the President's Management Agenda at the time, as opposed to having a farm team, as you pointed out. And I know, situations, events take hold, and you need to make sure you have the right people in place. But management can take a back seat if you're overcome by the day's events.
Right? That's true. And you pay for it.
Healthcare.gov being one example, I would think.
Yes, and I think one of the things that that was important to healthcare.gov was, and there are issues there. It shows the difference an individual makes, that Tom Daschle was to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and he also was to have a position in the White House. I mean, as an experienced Washington person, both a House member and a senator and a leader, and somebody who worked on health care issues, he knew the importance of the White House as far as the engine for policy. And so he wanted to have that spot so that he would be close to the president and be able to handle the issue in a lot of different ways. And both his knowledge of the issue, his knowledge of government, and the knowledge of the whole health community was going to be critical. And I just can't imagine that the same thing would have happened if he had been running it.
So what's next, both in presidential transition, more importantly, what's next? What's your next research area? I know I saw you had a wonderful kickoff that the Partnership for Public Service did, and you were up there with Clay Johnson and Chris Liu, and you mentioned that you were thinking about talking about the current president's communication, his interviews, 1,000 interviews you had mentioned, which is so maybe you could talk about the future in terms of this particular topic and your next topic.
Yes. Well, I'm going to work on the White House Transition Project again. Okay. And I've retired from teaching, although I'll go back and teach from time to time at Towson. But I wanted to devote my time to running the project so that we can gather information for more White House offices than we currently have. And then getting back to White House communications. And so I keep a database of all the interchanges that a president has. And so I have them back to Ronald Reagan. So I chart their press conferences, their short question and answer sessions. That's when somebody yells a question, when there's a meeting in the Oval Office that the press has been allowed in at the top or the bottom of the meeting, and then the interviews that a president has. And for Obama, interviews have been very important. Yeah. So he's had about 940 interviews, and that is more than George W. Bush and Clinton combined. And so they used more of the short question and answer sessions than he did. He doesn't like those, and so he.
Yeah, I'd like to. Before we close, I'd like to get your sense, given your perspective as an observer, is that a style aspect? Is that a style thing between the presidents, or is that something that their communication directors tell them to do, or why do they choose those different formats?
There are a couple of reasons. One is style. The president likes to talk at length. You can see that in his press conferences. You know, he might give an answer of 10 minutes to a question. That's better suited for an interview that's going to be on one particular issue. And so he likes interviews for that reason, because he can develop arguments. You know, he's a lawyer and was an academic. So time in answering a question, you want to that isn't a big factor. You want to bring in all the buts and wherefores. And so he likes interviews for that reason. But also, you've got a very fragmented media, and you can't get the time. Like, say, with Reagan, by this point, he would have had, I think he had about 30 nighttime news conferences mostly from the East Room. And a president can't get that kind of time today. That Bush, Clinton, and Obama all have had four. Wow. And of the nighttime, because you can't get the time. So with a fragmented media, what you want to do is figure out how you're going to get to people. And one of the ways you can do that, that the Obama people are using, is do interviews where you're sure that you're going to reach different platforms. So it may be an interview, like say with Tom Friedman, his recent interview with Tom Friedman of the New York Times, and that was a video that had, and then the article that Friedman wrote, when you looked at it online, you could get clips of particular segments of that interview. And then you could get the interview itself. So you could get the interview as a transcript, or you could get the interview as a video. And so how the interview is promoted is an important thing for the White House. So when President was doing his pressing for trade legislation and the Trade Promotion Authority, he wanted to reach Democrats who would normally support him, but who were against him on this issue. So they did an interview with Yahoo News with Matt Bai. And in that interview, when he wrote his article, there were embedded clips in it. And then the full interview, the video of it, came out later. And that reached 100 million people. And because now it's worldwide and you can reach people worldwide. So it's a very different media than it was in Reagan's time.
Largely before the advent of the 24-hour news cycle and internet.
And cable.
And cable, yeah.
And then the internet.
Well, you got a lot to work on there. I mean, that's your next project. Well, Martha, thanks for coming in today. It's great to have you back. And when you finish with your next tome, I'd love to have you. We have an open invitation.
Oh, thank you very much, Michael. I look forward to it.
This has been a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Martha Kumar, author of Before the Oath, How George W. Bush and Barack Obama Managed the Transfer of Power. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.